From KCUR 89.3, I'm Brian Ellison.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, I am Jason Rosenbaum.
And this is a special joint podcast of Statehouse Blend Missouri.
And Politically Speaking.
So we are upstairs at the Missouri State Capitol on the fifth floor. Today, earlier, Eric Greitens was sworn in as Missouri's 56th governor.
And we thought it would be a good idea for these two mighty forces of Missouri political podcasting to join together to interview the leaders of the Missouri House. Let's hit the music.
Joining us are Representative Gail McCann-Beatty, who is the House Minority Floor Leader. Representative Beatty, welcome back.
Thank you.
And welcome to our Politically Speaking for the first time.
This is awesome. Thank you very much.
And also Representative Kip Kendrick, who's a Democrat from Columbia and the Minority Whip. And it's nice to have you for the first time on Statehouse Blend Missouri.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And welcome back to Politically Speaking for the second time.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Jason.
So I'll start. Well, we haven't planned a detailed script here, as is fairly obvious. So let me start by just asking each of you your initial thoughts on the governor's inaugural address. Representative Beatty?
Well, we really didn't get to hear a whole lot, but some of it seems his reoccurring theme is change. And I think we've seen some of that with some of his new executive orders. As you know, ethics has been one of our priorities, and clearly he is making it his as well. So I am looking forward to trying to work with him on some of these things and see where that goes.
A big question that I've asked about this entire debate over ethics is whether the focus on paring down lobbyist gifts or making it harder for legislators to become lobbyists is really the right focus. Because if people are going to make bad moral decisions, it doesn't seem like that has anything to do with curbing lobbyist largesse. Do you feel like what the governor said and what he wants and what Republican legislators are proposing, at least in the House, is going to be enough to change the culture here in Jefferson City?
Well, I think it's a small step toward doing that. I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure that this really should be the biggest priority. Campaign finance limits are obviously, at least in my opinion, a much greater point that we need to deal with, and we did in some respects through Amendment 2. However, there's no denying that the public sees this as a major problem.
I'm not forgetting Kip Kendrick, who's here with us, but when you say you dealt in part with it with Amendment 2, would you like to see further limitations on campaign contributions?
Well, one of the things that Amendment 2 does is it really kind of shifts the power over to the House and Senate campaign committees, and I am afraid that we are actually creating less transparency by going this route rather than greater transparency.
Because donations to those committees are not limited by the amendment.
Absolutely.
And also not limited are local and county committees. Do either of you foresee a scenario where somebody would open up, say, a committee for mayor or county commissioner, use that as a conduit to raise millions of dollars, and then, especially if some of the aspects of Amendment 2 get struck down, basically render Amendment 2 useless that way?
I think people are always going to find that loophole. And so we have to be very careful on how we script these things and do what we can to curb that. Unfortunately, the public doesn't necessarily see those things and recognize that that's probably even more dangerous than what we had before.
Did I just give politicians around the state an idea of how to get around Amendment 2?
Well,
I think
could
I
have
just
possibly
did.
Done that.
We'll call that pulling a Rosenbaum.
To be fair, though, I've been talking about this for a long time, and I'm not trying to convince people to get around Amendment 2. I'm just saying that at a state where lieutenant governor candidates got million-dollar donations, I don't see that as an unrealistic possibility. And I know that they did that for a reason, because they didn't want the amendment to be struck down on constitutional grounds, but it's a reality, and it's also going to make local races more expensive, especially in Kansas City.
Absolutely.
Maybe Columbia. I don't know if someone would spend $1 million to be mayor of Columbia. I certainly wouldn't, but, you know.
Well, there's nothing wrong with Columbia, but Kip Kendrick, what was your impression of the inaugural address today?
Well, you know, I didn't hear anything in there that surprised me. A lot of the similar themes of what we heard during a campaign, ethics reform, change, you know, making sure that Missouri that there's justice in Missouri. So, you know, I think he hit on some of the regular themes that he had been hitting on throughout the campaign. But, you know, tomorrow's, I guess today, as of right now, is a new day. We're going to have to get around to governing, and so it'll be an interesting session. A lot of unknowns out there with the new administration, and some knowns about what's going to move, but a lot of questions still remain.
Now, one thing that I think has become fait accompli after Greitens won the governorship is that Republicans in the legislature are going to propose a whole bunch of things to curb organized labor, whether it be quote-unquote right to work, which is shorthand for a policy that no longer would allow labor unions and employers to require payment of dues as a condition of employment. It is a mouthful to say, but I think that I got that right, as well as barring automatic deductions of dues and maybe prevailing wage. From talking with Republican legislative leaders, it's not really a question of if those are things are going to happen, but when. And there's not really much of a pathway for Democrats who oppose those things to stop them. So given that a whole new reality is about to come down for organized labor in this state, from talking with labor unions, are you getting a sense that they're kind of ready to reinvent themselves in this new world? Or are they going to try to put up one last ditch effort to fight these things, even though they probably know what the outcome is?
My guess is probably they're going to put up that one last ditch effort. I think we'll see some kind of petition process going on to take the vote to the people, which is what I said it should be done anyway. This is a huge change for our state. And my concern is that we are not pushing right to work because we believe that it is right for the people, but we're pushing right to work because it's an agenda for a couple of very powerful billionaires. And someone asked me earlier today, well, why do you feel that way? And my response was simply follow the money.
I mean, is it as simple as that, though? I mean, clearly there are right to work. There are 27 other right to work states. I mean, this is a nationwide agenda of a movement that doesn't that wants to take that position.
And labor unions spent millions of dollars to try to prevent this.
Right. Absolutely.
So I want to make that clear, but continue.
No, but so I guess my question is, isn't this there's a broader fight here, right? This is not just about one particular piece of legislation.
Right. Which is why my argument is we should take it to the people, and let them tell us, do they want this to be a right to work state?
I think one of the challenges of getting that on the ballot is that while organized labor is strong in Kansas City and St. Louis, mm-hmm. where I think there are combined two or three congressional districts, it has really lost its luster in other parts of the state
outstate.
Where you need those signatures. There's right. not a lot of union members in southern Missouri or northeast Missouri anymore. So is that going to be a structural barrier to getting that on the ballot, that you just may not find a lot of people interested in stopping right to work in places where you need those signatures?
I think without a question, it is an uphill battle. But I think it's probably a battle that labor is willing to take on.
So I think there's a broader question here than just about labor. It's sort of about every issue where Republicans dominate. And of course, they've dominated before. They've had veto-proof majorities. But now they're operating with a certain confidence, knowing that they don't have a governor's veto pen to help that they will have to override. I guess my question, you're the Democratic whip, Representative Kendrick. You have to count all these votes. What does collaboration even look like? Do you sense, especially on the House side, any motivation to collaborate anyway? Is there any way that Democrats can have an impact on legislation, or is it going to be one unsuccessful vote for you after another?
That's a million-dollar question right now, right?
not to put too fine a point on
no,
it.
No, no, thank you. So I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about this every evening, right? So, you know, I mean, I think it's going to be challenging to figure out where our leverage is at times. And there are going to be clear issues where we just don't agree. Right to work, there's going to be some legal reforms, some education reforms too, vouchers potentially, that where we just fundamentally disagree on what the policy should be. And there's a very good possibility on some of these major policy shifts that we're just not going to have the votes to be able to stop it. But that being said, there are a lot of issues that move forward here in the state that aren't necessarily partisan. I do think that we're going to have leverage. It's just a matter of figuring out where it is and what's appropriate for us to be able to compromise and cooperate on.
Can you, any examples? Are there issues where you think you might have leverage or where you think you could have an impact?
Well, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of movement this year on ways to shore up the budget. We're looking at $200 million in withholds by Governor Nixon. Potential for another $200 million in withhold coming this next week from Governor Greitens. FY18, the budget's looking like it's going to be an absolute mess. So there's going to be, I think, a real opportunity for us to take a look at not only tax credits, but maybe also taking a look at some other programs out there. That are these necessary to continue funding, or do we need to make some cuts in order to fund other priorities in the state?
Now, Representative Kendrick, the last time you were on Politically Speaking, we talked extensively about the Democratic misfortunes in a place that's very close to your heart, Northeast Missouri. Before this election cycle, when someone like Donald Trump was getting 70 and 80% of the vote in counties that used to be Democratic like 5 and 10 years ago. So the reason I'm asking this question without rehashing the election, which I kind of am, how are the Democrats going to get out of the supermajority if they're not competing and not doing well at all in places that they were doing fine 5 and 10 years ago? And how do you prepare to kind of get out of this abyss? Because if you don't get out of the supermajority, you're not going to be able to effectuate much policy over the next 5 to 10 years.
Correct. there's no one single answer, right? I mean, it's going to take a lot of different levers being pulled at the same time. We have to make sure that we have candidates in Northeast Missouri and Southeast Missouri, and we have to field candidates where we haven't been fielding candidates. We have to make sure that there is a unified message, not only a message of opposition at times and what we feel that the Republicans have done to worsen the situation for the state, but we also need a clear message on what we plan to do to move this state forward. Maybe that's lacking at times, but we have to have a message about what it's going to take to make Missouri better for everyone.
Is one of the challenges when you're doing battle legislatively is you're facing off against people like Todd Richardson or Elijah Haar, who are very skilled both from a public policy standpoint and from a political standpoint. Does that make your job more difficult when we're just talking about the legislative give and take that your Republican counterparts are not pushovers, basically?
That is very true. They're not. You know, I have a good relationship with the speaker. He's very talented. You know, I say he's a very smooth guy and fair at times. But, you know, I mean, Republicans in the House leadership, Senate leadership, and the Republican governor, they're going to have to lead. They're going to have to figure out how to get the FY18 budget to work. They're going to have to do that without raising taxes. I mean, there's not going to be an appetite to raise taxes. They're going to make some major cuts to public higher education. They're going to make some major cuts potentially to public safety, maybe to transportation, which can't really take any more cuts. Mm-hmm. It's gotten to the point where, you know, one silver lining of having Republican governors, they're going to have to govern now. And I expect there will be a push for special interest tax cuts, continued tax cuts. But at the same time, I hope there's a pushback from the Greitens administration that says, we just cannot continue to do this.
So let me ask another political question. Another place where there's a pretty significant divide on a partisan level is between urban and rural settings in Missouri. If we look at the map, there's a blue bubble around St. Louis, there's a blue bubble around Kansas City, and there's a little blue bubble where you represent there.
Not as blue as it Kendrick. Used to be.
And even that one's not as blue as it used to be, but we're looking at a vast sea of red for pretty much the rest of the state. We're talking about trying to cultivate future candidates, future potential leadership for Democrats in Missouri. Is there any kind of candidate who can appeal outside of those blue bubbles? And I ask that after an election where we saw Chris Koster defeated by 6 points and attorney general candidate defeated by 11 points. You know, no one was really close. How do you start building back? And is that rural-urban divide part of the problem, Representative Bailey?
Well, the rural-urban divide is absolutely there. And I think we have to do a better job with our messaging and reaching out to rural Democrats, because there are rural Democrats. I think part of the challenge we had, too, is perhaps people were a little complacent in this election, thinking it was a give, that Chris Koster was going to win. And in some minds, there was a given that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And no one ever dreamed that we would be talking President Donald Trump. I think it is incumbent upon us to re-energize our Democratic base. Not going to be easy, but something that we're absolutely going to have to do.
And is there a Democratic message that appeals to the rural part of the state that you can think of?
I think we're still talking the same family values that we always have, living wages, quality education. When we look at our rural communities, those high schools are the center of those communities, so they are very much wanting a quality public education. When we talk about bringing jobs into our state, we have to be providing a quality workforce. What our message is has to change, but how we present it has to change.
I know we just got over one election, but I know that one of your former colleagues, former Representative Stephen Weber, is now the chairman of the Missouri Democratic Party. I've known Stephen even before he was in elected office. Mm-hmm. He was what I would consider a gold star candidate for the state Senate who lost, probably because of the red wave, but also because Caleb Rowden ran an excellent campaign himself. But my feeling is he has a lot of work to do, but he also has the possibility of being a statewide candidate in 4 years. As somebody who served with them, I guess we're getting speculation going on this show.
That's
first.
What we do. It's a podcast.
Would he be the type of leader that you think you could rally around in 4 years, maybe for governor or some of the other down ballot offices?
You know, I have regular conversations with Stephen, and right now he's solely focused on being executive director of Missouri Democratic Party. I think he's so focused right now on doing what's right to get the Democratic Party back around, you know, and he's got such a large job in front of him that I don't even want to speculate.
Okay, well then let me ask you to speculate a little further. Are there other candidates? You don't have to have inside knowledge, but just from things that you, as you look out at the field, who would you like to see?
That's the reason I brought that up, because your bench seems pretty thin right now, and you need somebody to field these offices.
And frankly, the two of you are near the top of the bench as legislative leaders when you don't have any statewide offices except auditors. So who would you like to see in the pipeline to be Democratic candidates?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that I believe... skirt your question a little bit, I guess. So I apologize. I'll be completely
honest. Imagine that.
Right. But I think one thing that this election has done is it has woken Democrats up nationally and in the state. We can't be complacent. I do believe that we're going to see some Democratic values or be undone. Some things that we've really been standing for to be threatened, and I think people are going to kind of wake up more so than they have been in the recent past. And we're going to see people start stepping up and saying, you know, maybe it's my turn. Maybe I need to run for the House. Maybe I need to run for the Senate. Maybe I need to look at a statewide elected seat if I'm in a position to do it. So I think people around the state are going to start stepping forward in a way maybe that hasn't happened over the last 2 to 4 years.
Okay, I'm going to give Gail McCann Beatty an equal chance to skirt my question. Is there anyone that you can think of that you'd like to see as a candidate for statewide office for the Democrats?
I don't know. You know, I'm kind of in the same boat as Kip in this, that I don't know. It's a very small group that is here in the Capitol, and we bounce between, the Senate and the House. But really, I think our stars, we don't know who they're going to be just yet. But we will be actively out there recruiting. So if there is someone out there who is even remotely thinking about it, we're looking for you.
There's lots of Democrats in St. Louis, let me tell you.
Is there an underwriting fee for that little commercial that we just allowed on our podcast?
That would probably mean that we can afford our theme music.
Yeah. Hey, I want to thank both of you on a busy day after the inauguration
for coming up
and talking with us. Representative Gail McCann Beatty, the House Minority Leader, and Representative Kip Kendrick, the House Minority Whip. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And we're back with our joint podcast between State House Blend Missouri from KCUR.
And Politically Speaking with St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're now joined by the Speaker of the Missouri House, Todd Richardson. Speaker Richardson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Let's start with what's the obvious question on everyone's mind. You just were outside for Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' inauguration. What'd you think of his address?
Yeah, it's an exciting day. I think it's really fun for us to be able to welcome in what's, I think, going to be truly a new era in Missouri state government. And for those of us old-timers like me, I can call myself an old-timer since I'm in my final term now, having been here 6 years, it's going to be really exciting to see some of the things that we've worked on over that period of time and have a partner in the governor's office to work with us.
You know, I think a lot of folks have said over the course of the last couple weeks when there's been a lot of talk about the change and the excitement, you know, there are a couple issues that Governor Nixon vetoed, but the Republicans have had a veto-proof majority for several years now. What do you feel like has really changed?
Well, I think having that willing partner in the executive is just, there's no way, unless you've worked in this building, to describe what the impact is. And, you know, it's not just the issues that the governor vetoes. It's the entire topic of conversation often gets framed by what kinds of issues the governor's willing to work with you on and what's not.
Now, one of the elephants in the room here, and I guess since we're interviewing a Republican, I can use that horrible metaphor, is that, you know, during the primary and even after the primary, there were a lot of legislators from your party that weren't really sold on Greitens. Even after he beat the three other opponents, they were kind of miffed about this refrain that Jefferson City's corrupt.
Corrupt career politicians.
And that kind of put Republican leaders in a net as well. But I've been talking with a lot of Republicans, and they like what Governor Greitens has done with staffing. They like how he's being more collaborative with the legislature. Is that kind of a sign that some of the wariness that was there post and pre-primary is maybe fading away? Or is some of that rhetoric still has hard feelings?
Oh, I certainly think some of that's fading away. And I think, honestly, I think a little bit, some of it was overblown to begin with. You know, everybody, from the House's perspective, everybody in the Missouri House, the longest anyone has served would be Representative Engler. And he's certainly been here 12 years?
I was going to say 100 years, but as insulting as possible.
It hasn't been that long. But for the most part, we don't have any, other than Representative Engler, we don't have any House members who've been here longer than 6 years. And every single person, myself included, we ran for office because we wanted to see things change. And Governor Greitens ran essentially on that same platform, that platform of changing the way things are done in Jefferson City and changing the policies that govern the state. So I think as people have gotten past, the harsh nature of that campaign, they're finding that there's a lot of common ground with the governor.
One thing that I've heard from some of your Republican colleagues, including State Representative Kevin Engler, who was around during the Matt Blunt administration, is now that there is a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, and with such robust numbers, the Republicans can't really blame Democrats if things go wrong.
Sure.
So that's kind of a downside. If the state takes a turn for the worse, it might be bad news for the GOP. How does that feeling come into play as you're moving forward on this agenda?
Well, there's no question. When you have both supermajorities in the House, supermajorities in the Senate, and the governor's office, there's an increased responsibility on us to govern. And I think the way that we intend to do it is by following through on the things that we told voters as a party we were going to work on in the campaign. And I think if we'll keep focused on that, the state will be taken in a better direction. And I think people will see the results of that legislation.
You know, one of the things that theme of responsibility is something you mentioned in your opening address last week. And I think you said with greater power comes greater responsibility.
Right. Isn't that a quote from Spider-Man?
Yes, I believe that. Isn't
I didn't even know that. That was one of somebody pointed that out to me, and I had no idea. So
Spider-Man may not have been the first, actually, but we'll look that up. We'll tweet about that.
Yeah.
But
I think Spider-Man's a good person to be quoting. I mean,
I would agree.
Yeah.
You could do worse. You went on from there to talk about that responsibility includes hearing the voices of all Missourians,
sure,
including those that all of you represent. And I think you were talking to the Democrats there, saying you're working to incorporate all of those voices in as practical a terms as you can. What does that look like? What does collaboration or working together or incorporating all those voices look like at a time when you don't really have to work with them because of the numbers you have?
Well, I had the opportunity to be in this building way back when the partisanship was the exact opposite. My father served in this building from 90 to 02, and I can remember as a teenager seeing how a super minority of Republicans was treated by a super majority of Democrats. And I didn't think it was right the way they were treated at the time. And so that's an experience that I've always been mindful of as I've been the speaker. We're going to move the policy agenda that we want to move as a caucus. But that doesn't mean that we have to be disrespectful of the minority or to shut them out of the debate. And beyond that, there are a whole host of issues which aren't particularly partisan. Workforce development is one that comes to mind almost immediately. It's a critical economic development challenge for this state, and it really doesn't have anything to do with partisanship. So we're going to look for and identify the kinds of issues where we can work across the aisle. But even on the deep contentious issues where there are true philosophical divides, we're going to be mindful and respectful of the voices that disagree with us.
One issue that I know Democrats have been interested in, and we talked about this on a previous show, is paid parental leave.
Yeah.
And I saw that Representative Jay Barnes had introduced a bill for state workers, and you had said before that you're going to use this as a springboard to broader. I want to ask a more broad question, because I've noticed that people in both parties, both male and female, a mm-hmm. lot of them are between our age, 30 and yeah. 40, raising young kids. I'm wondering if you've heard from a lot of your colleagues that, you know, the lack of paid family leave is a practical problem for us as we serve in the legislature, for either us or our spouses, and that maybe is providing some motivation to get this done.
Yeah, I think it certainly is, and I think, you know, we do have a younger legislature than we've had before. I somebody needs to count up the number of children under the age of 14 that are associated with a member of the legislature, yeah. because it's a large number right now.
It's enormous at this point.
I do. If you take just the Representative Vescovo and Representative Barnes clans alone, you've yeah. got a big number there. But I do think it's informing the conversation some, and I think this has also been a conversation that's been ongoing nationally for some time.
So from something that might have some bipartisan traction to something that doesn't have any bipartisan traction at all, right to work is...
Well, that's not true. I mean, but right to work's been passed in the Missouri House with both Democrats and Republicans voting for
it. Like one or two Democrats, yeah. but continue.
Fair enough. and that is often the case in the Missouri legislature,
sure.
right? There's not necessarily strict party line votes on very many things. But generally speaking, Democrats have opposed right to work. And of course, only isn't law now because of Governor Jay Nixon's
right.
veto pen. And by all accounts, it seems headed for passage. On what kind of schedule do you see that happening?
Well, I think it's something we're going to move, as I've said, very early in session. It's going to the hearing on that bill is going to have hearing Tuesday of this week, the day after the inauguration. And so I anticipate it'll move from there very quickly to the floor.
Even more quickly, this morning, the House General Laws Committee held a hearing on one of the ethics reform proposals that's out there, and then on 11-1 vote, passed it on. That's the ban on gifts from lobbyists. I've heard people saying that this might pass the House as early as this week. Is that your hope?
Yeah, my hope is that we can get it to the floor this week and begin debate on it. I said at the end of last session that it was going to be the first bill that would leave the House. It will be the first bill that leaves the House. And it's really something that I consider sort of unfinished business from last year. So my hope is that we can get it through the process quickly, and then we'll move on to the other substantive priorities we've got.
I know this is a question I've been asking for well over a year, but I'll ask it again since lobbyist gifts and the revolving doors on top of mind. Do you really feel that these issues are going to change the culture in Jefferson City when a lot of the reasons we're talking about ethics come down to bad personal decisions and things that may not be able to be legislated?
Well, I don't think that's the only reason we're talking about these policies. Frankly, we were talking about these before some of the more high-profile personal instances that we had over the last couple of years. But I do think the combination of things that we're trying to do to improve overall the culture here in Jeff City will improve the environment here. And beyond that, I think it's just the right thing to do. And so we're going to keep moving forward on it. My hope is that it improves the culture here in Jeff City. And I think over time it will.
Another of those ethics proposals is from Governor Greitens, a revolving door ban, one for one, a year in the House means a year not serving as a lobbyist. We've already heard a fair number of senators saying they think that's DOA on the Senate side. Is it going to get hearings on the House side? Are we going to see action on that bill?
Well, the House passed the revolving door ban we have in place now last year. We actually were in favor of a longer ban. So we'll work with the governor to see where we can get that policy.
I have a curveball question to this.
All right, great.
Which is, I guess, my specialty.
Now
that there is a Republican governor and there's all these statewide office holders and there are copious amounts of positions for departing legislators, is it possible we may see a reduction of Republicans who are termed out of the legislature who may want to go into lobbying and they may try to find a position within state government instead? And this problem may just kind of sort itself out over the next 4 to 8 years.
Well, I do think it's possible. And I think, you know, even though the 6-month ban was not as long a ban as I would have liked to have passed last year, I think that in and of itself changes some of the dynamic. When people are forced to sit out for a period of time and spend a little longer in the recovering politician space, they tend to find other opportunities and move on. But I do think there'll be opportunities in the administration and in the other statewide offices for good public servants to continue that work.
Like Caleb Jones, for example.
Caleb Jones.
Jumping back to some of those issues that may have certainly some bipartisan interest, if not always agreement, transportation and infrastructure needs are something that Kansas City politicians talk a lot about.
Sure.
But haven't felt like they've seen a lot of action on over the last couple of sessions of the General Assembly. Do you see that moving forward in this session?
Yeah, I think transportation is critically important for the state overall, and I think figuring out where we're going to go in terms of funding our transportation networks critical.
What's your idea about that? Would you see some sources of increased revenue for transportation that are obvious to you?
I think what we need to do first is we need to start with breaking this challenge down into manageable chunks. And, you know, we've looked at transportation for so long as this massive problem. And the reality is we don't have a solution. There is no solution for a massive problem. I-70 alone is a $3 billion project. There's not a single revenue solution that anybody's proposed that's a $3 billion solution. So I think we ought to start by trying to find some general revenue sources to continue to fund transportation. And from there, we need to come up with a plan to fund the interstates.
But nothing that would involve tax increases, I'm guessing.
I don't see any support for that in the legislature in the short term.
One of the other things that I think at least an advisor for Governor Greitens has talked about is paring down historic and low-income tax credits. That's always a really controversial issue, but this is coming at a time when the state's budget is going through a lot of problems, and we have these two tax credits that end up taking a lot of money out of the state's coffers.
Sure.
So I'm curious if there's going to be a more successful effort to deal with those tax credits or lower the caps on them than, say, the disastrous 2011 special session, which I see you smirking about. I know you probably don't remember it as fondly as I do.
Yes. Well, you referred to it as disastrous, so I don't know if I could remember any less fondly than that. But I was smirky because I actually saw one of your journalistic colleagues from Kansas City in the hallway just a few minutes ago when we were reliving the story of the 2011 special session.
It is hard to forget, but continue, sir.
But I do think that there will be an appetite for tax credit reform across the board, and I think there's an appetite for a broader look at what the state's tax structure should be, and I'm very hopeful that there'll be progress on that. In my mind, the way to, and it really is born out of that 2011 experience, what we ought to do in terms of trying to reform tax credit is not always look for the big home run solution, the grand bargain, because when you do that, and we saw this on ethics reform for years and years and years, this is the reason why we broke them up into single subject bills. When you take these issues in smaller chunks, you tend to have a better opportunity for success.
But there's going to be a lot of political pushback, for example,
sure,
if you lower the cap on low-income housing tax credits. It's not only the developers and the people that profit from those.
Sure.
It's going to be advocates of low-income housing, which is a really important aspect of not only urban Missouri, but rural Missouri as well. So how do you strike that balance?
Well, that's what the legislative process is going to be about, and it's not easy. And you've been around this building long enough to see
to see
how difficult some of those challenges are. But look, that's why we create the kind of process where we can have fair and open dialogue. And I think if we'll put the right people working on this problem, we'll come up with where that balance is.
I guess I just have to ask this question, and maybe it's a self-serving one, and it's to somebody who's not sharing my faith, but we did pass a historical symbolic milestone today. There's never been a Jewish person ever elected governor before, and especially after 2015 when, as a Missouri political community, we're dealing this wrenching conversation about whether there's anti-Semitism in Missouri politics. It seems that Eric Greitens' election, where he carried most of rural Missouri, and also, I have to just point this out, Jason Kander almost unseating a U.S. senator is a big counterpoint to that. As somebody from rural Missouri and as a leader of the Republican Party, what kind of message do you think it sends that Missouri elected its first and inaugurated its first Jewish governor and he happens to be a Republican?
Yeah, I think it sends a powerful message and a powerfully positive message. That's not something that's going to hold a candidate back in this state. We are a state of deep faith, and we have strong faith communities across the state. And I know that faith is something that informs Governor-elect Greitens as it does me. And our faith may not be identical, but I think his election demonstrates that is not the kind of issue that represents a barrier to elected office in Missouri, and I think that's an extraordinarily positive thing.
As we move toward wrapping up this conversation, as you look back on the festivities of the day, and I know they aren't over yet, the inaugural ball, I know we are keeping you from getting your black tie.
That's quite all right.
give it a few more minutes.
Yeah.
But as you think back on the inaugural ceremony and on Governor Greitens' address, what will stick with you from this day? What will speak to you as this session moves forward?
I think what I'll remember about today is and I hope it's something that Missourians remember, too, that this is the point at which we began a dramatic turnaround for our state and moved the state to a place where we've got a strong, vibrant, dynamic economy that's allowing the kinds of upward mobility that we want to see here. And so I hope people look back, by the end of the year and the next year, and they see today as a starting point for that transition.
All right. Any other questions here, Jason?
I have no other questions.
Well, then I am pleased. I know you've been on Politically Speaking before, but this is your first time with us on State House Blend.
I'm glad to do it. We'll not make it the last.
Well, I hope not, and I hope that what I'm about to ask you doesn't make it the last. This is it is part of our tradition that we ask our guest to choose the music that we will close the show with.
And it's not a tradition on Politically Speaking. I've chosen the music every time, and every time he's on the show, I choose Neutral Milk Hotel. But continue, Brian.
And so that's an option. You can go that way if you choose, but the ball is in your court, Speaker Richardson.
All right. How about I will give you all the choice of any Garth Brooks song you choose. Heading down to my former home in Memphis on February the 3rd to see Garth live in concert. Very excited about that. So I'll let you fill it in with whatever Garth Brooks song you'd like.
Can it be from the Chris Gaines era?
No Chris Gaines era. It's got to be true Garth Brooks.
I'm looking at my colleague, Jason Rosenbaum, because I, of course, can't think of a single Garth Brooks song.
Would it be insulting if we did Friends in Low Places?
That's the one we sing at Royals games with Garth Brooks.
I think that would be perfectly appropriate, both for the speaker from Popper Bluff and because of the Kansas City connection. How about that?
Friends in Low Places it is. House Speaker Todd Richardson of Poplar Bluff, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to my good friend and colleague, Jason Rosenbaum.
Thank you for having me as well.
It was a pleasure to bring you this joint podcast of Politically Speaking
and State House Blend.
Our producer today has been Matt Hodapp. See you on the radio. Thought you'd see there, and I saw the surprise and the fear in his eyes.